This week on the Barag World Show, we talk about digital standards and re-energising card sorting. This week's show is sponsored by Teacup AdWords and Full Story. World Show, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is Paul Barag and joining me today is Marcus Jetlag Lillington. Hello. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I am very confident this is going to be the worst show we've ever done. Because you've got jet lag and I feel as sick as a dog.
Are you poorly, Paul?
Well, you know, man flu.
You need more vitamins in your diet, or vitamins, as because I've just come back from America.
You say this, but, you know.
But you're often poorly. I worry about you, Paul.
I'm sickly.
I'm a sickly child. Yes. Yeah, I don't feel too bad, I have to say. I managed to upgrade on the way home, which was rather
nice.
Yes. I can't say how, but I just did.
Ooh, mysterious. Yeah. Who did you bribe?
Connections. Well, that's all I can say. No, it's good. But Lee and I managed the business class tickets were cheaper than the premium economy ones on economy. See, I can't speak. Blah, blah. Put my teeth back in. They were cheaper on the way out than premium economy. So we flew out business class. And it's much more fun when you're awake.
Yes.
You can enjoy
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Yeah. The reason I'm sick, I've decided, is because we went to IWMW last week, which is a conference like we go to every year, and it's just interacting with other human beings. My immune system's not used to it anymore.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, although I haven't got anything, but then maybe I interact with people more. The client that we've just come back from, it's the company that we used to work for, Dixon Shapiro, that obviously you worked at. It's the it's the company that basically bought them out.
Okay.
So we were back in the same meeting rooms and offices. It was a bit deja vu.
Ooh, it was very weird.
But yeah, but my point there is a connection, is that there were lots of them. So maybe I'm going to come down with something nasty too.
Yeah, because you weren't at the conference last week that long. And also, you didn't drink as much as I did.
Oh, I did, Paul.
Oh, did you?
Yes. Because I didn't realise that you weren't speaking till the last morning.
Mm.
So I thought, well, we'll all go. Me, you, Chris will go out on the Wednesday night. But you were like, oh, no, I've got to speak tomorrow. So I went to bed. We went out in the town, man.
Well, I had an interesting night before. Yes. So, you know, I wasn't really up for doing it again. It's such a good conference. I so love that one. Everybody's just so nice, aren't they? And well, they're not. They're really rude to me, but you know, in a nice way,
in a like they like you way.
Yes.
Yeah. They are pretending to like you in a really, really genuine way.
Yeah. Very convincing. And also, you know, I can see, because we've been going, what, to that for 10 years, over 10 years?
Yeah, it must be.
I can now see my propaganda and indoctrination beginning to stick with them. Do you know what I mean? It was like so much of this year's conference was about all the stuff I bang on about. We all got very excited about digital governance. How sad's that?
Yeah, you know what the best moment was for me?
What's that?
When I was asked to hand out the quiz sheets.
Did you feel like you were one of the boys then?
I was accepted, even though I'm on the dark side from a third-party supplier. I really can't speak today. From a third-party supplier, I was handed out quiz sheets. Naughty
What's thing. That weird noise?
That was my phone going beep-boop, but it's turned off now.
Okay. So, yeah, I did find it a bit depressing, mine, because they've got so good. Everybody's so switched on now. It's like I'm going to have to up my game.
Mm-hmm.
That's the trouble with being a consultant. You have to. It's like being a teacher, isn't it? You have to be one step ahead of the class.
That is very true. Although I think that HE are a long way ahead of other industries.
Which is a bizarre thing to say, because for a long time they were anything but.
Yes, but it does. It is, your indoctrination has worked, Paul, and yeah, there's a lot of good people.
I tell you, who know a lot. I said this in one of my talk that you didn't stay around for because you don't love me enough. Where I actually said, I think that the people in that room were possibly the world's authority at herding cats. Do you know what I mean? It's like, nowhere have I come across that is so devolved and so chaotic as HE. So, yeah, good for them. So there we go. So that's what we've been doing, which is really exciting for everybody.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, if somebody's vaguely university-like and has never been, go.
And I think, yeah, not only that, I think what that says is go to conferences. They're great.
Yeah, I know. This is why I'm going to see you speak in Barcelona in October, Paul.
Yeah.
Because I have to go to more conferences, and they have to be in places like Barcelona. No, they don't have to be in places like Barcelona. No, I am... both Chris and
helps.
I are really bad. We just kind of... You know, as I've said in this podcast over the past couple of years, things are going well, we're busy, we've got lots to do. But that's not enough. You need to continue to be part of the community, which we're bad at, and I need to be kicked up the arse, basically, and get out there and talk to people.
Yes. Yeah, you're not alone on that. I think a lot of people are like that, you know, and it's very easy just to kind of plod along in your little corner. And okay, I know, you know, you can learn everything online that you could ever learn at a conference, but it's meeting people, it's being with people, it's moaning about problems, and, you know, it's just so good. It's so good. Anyway. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So let's talk about our first sponsor, and then we can get into our first talk. Because this season, although we have talks, is not a replacement for a conference. Just to be clear. Right. Full Story first up. So Full Story. Oh, I just love this app so much. I've been using it this week. So one of the big problems I suffer from on my site, I'm going to just totally ignore my script now. I'm going to talk about myself rather than the sponsor.
You never sent me the script, so I can't even follow the script because...
Have I not sent it to you this time?
No.
Oh, that's why
how
you've
much
got,
you care, Paul.
That's why you've got no comments in the script. I see.
Have them here written in fine handwriting.
Lovely. So, yeah, one of the things that I've been struggling with is bounce rate on my site. That I want to encourage people to explore and look at more than one post. And you know, I recognize that's not always... It's, a bounce rate by itself is not an inherent problem, but it's something I've been working on. And one of the areas that I've found I was suffering from is on the homepage. So I redesigned my homepage a little bit. And I had it on the homepage, I had this big, long, blare text at the top saying what the site's about and stuff. So I had a feeling that wasn't quite working. And I was looking at my analytics, I was looking at Full Story, should I say, and I was watching some user sessions of people on the homepage, and they just shot past it. You know, they didn't stop and read it. So I thought, well, let's get rid of it. So I got rid of it, and instead what I've done is I've put three buttons, one to the blog, one to the podcast, and one to my books. And I've been watching sessions, and I can go in and actually go in and say, show me any sessions where people have clicked on this or haven't clicked on this. And I can look at what percentage of people click on it and don't click on it and all of that kind of stuff just by using CSS selectors or the text that's written on the button, for crying out loud, if you want to be really basic about it. And it's just been great seeing... You know, actually seeing users stop now, pause at that part of the screen, and then in a lot of cases actually click through and see the other stuff. So just being able to see those sessions is absolutely brilliant. But another really good thing that was particularly good about it was the fact that something I was doing on the page when I was messing around with it, it all worked fine for me. But while I was kind of looking at Full Story, I was finding that it was throwing up a JavaScript error for some people. And I wouldn't have known that if I hadn't have been looking at Full Story. Because, of course, Full Story allows you to look at the JavaScript errors and even get a detailed log of them and what's happened to them. And it even captures, you know, things that are you know, gnarly single page apps with React and Angular and all these other words I don't really understand anymore. So it's really great for actually kind of co-browsing with people to understand and troubleshoot their experience on the site. And you can even do that in real time as well. So you could tie it up with something like a live chat facility or something like that. So it's just so good. Full Story is brilliant. Anyway, go and find out more about it. Try it out for yourself. You can try it for absolutely free forever. Forever and ever. For you get 1,000 sessions of free per month. If you want to give the whole kind of shebang a go, in other words, not limited to 1,000 sessions, you can get their free pro account, or you can get their pro account free for a month. If you go to fullstory.com/BOAG, B-O-A-G. You don't even need a credit card, which is always a bonus. They're not going to suddenly start charging you at the end, which annoys me. All right. That's cool. That's that one. Done and dusted. Thank you, Full Story, for supporting the show. Let's talk about our first talk. It's a bit different this time. It's an interview.
Yeah, this confused me.
Oh, did it?
Yeah. I'm like, what's going on? Especially in my current state. Oh, I thought, I better listen to these. I haven't. Because normally I listen to them like the weekend before, but because I've been away, I thought, I'll come back and I'll have a listen. And I started playing this one and I was confused.
Oh, that's really sad. I'm sorry. I'm sorry I caused you such distress. No, it was that they wrote to me, and asked permission to do an interview because the lady didn't, you know, felt a bit funny about doing it herself. So, which was fine by me. Yeah. I don't care. You do it anywhere you want, and it works really well. So it's fine. Carolina. I knew that. I literally just stumbled over the word. But, of course, because I'm so bad at names, now everybody just presumes I'm an idiot. Anyway. She's a digital expert with over 17 years' experience in managing multilingual online products. Oh, lucky her. Multilingual. Flipping heck. I hate that. I don't mind it if it's Western character sets, but it's once you start getting into, like, Japanese or something, it all just gets very complicated. She's participated in enterprise level digital transformation project, a lady after my own heart, and in her latest adventure, wow, she has adventures, she is implementing digital governance for a highly decentralized global organization. Ooh, should we guess who that might be?
Well, it might be one we've worked for.
Yeah, I was thinking that. I was thinking exactly the same you were there.
Yeah,
yeah, lucky her. I hope she has more luck doing that than we did.
Yes.
So, she's going to talk about basically digital standards and how digital standards are so intrinsic to your digital success, which is a subject that I like to bang on about lots. So over to Carolina. Anyway, her.
So hi, Carolina. We've been talking about this thing called digital standards for a while. So I'm wondering if you can tell us all about these things we call digital standards and why are they so useful to an organization, especially one with a global online presence?
Hi, Christina. You know, when I speak about digital standards, I like to equate the organization's digital presence. By that, I mean the websites, the social media channels, the mobile apps to a city. And when I talk to it, I say to people, well, you know, you want to welcome visitors, make sure that they can visit the city, circulate, feel safe, find their way, discover buildings, sites. But, you know, the key for a well-organized city is that there are rules. And these need to be followed. So, for example, you can think about traffic rules that need to be respected, even building codes. So we could kind of equate those to policies. And then there are elements such as traffic lights, which we can actually equate to standards. So, for example, it's universally known or almost known that when a traffic light is in red, it means stop. When it's in orange, it will be caution. And when it's go, it's green. When it's green, it's go. So we're actually surrounded by standards. And if they did not exist, it would be actually a very chaotic world. And, you know, we can think about other things, the light bulb sizes, window sizes, the wheels in a car. So an organization's digital presence also needs to be properly managed. you know, so that our customers, our users feel safe, they feel excited, they can find information, the product, they can interact with us. So, you know, digital standards together with policies are really enables for an organization to have a strong digital presence. And, you know, they can be divided in different categories because actually digital is really at the center of multiple disciplines. Think about technology, communication, marketing, fundraising, design. And one categorization that I like is the one that Lisa Walshman does in her book, Managing Chaos. And she has them group in four categories. Design, so that could be, for example, your style guide. Another one will be editorial, so think about what will be your organization tone and voice. Then you have publishing and development, so think about your tools. For example, what will be the content management system that the organization is going to be using to manage their websites? And then you have the fourth one, which is networks and servers. So that has to do with your infrastructure, your hosting. Are you going to be using cloud, or are you going to be using, you know, third-party hosting? And, you know, certain of these standards could overlap into one of more than one category. It's also important that standards are mandatory and, you know, that you make them achievable, and then you can measure the adoption. So that is, in a bit of a nutshell, why digital standards, what they are, and that they're key really for a robust and strong digital presence for an organization, especially if it's a global one with its presence spread out through different countries and markets.
Oh, that's such a great description. I really like how you equate it to cities and in the traffic lights. So if someone really wanted to get the stoplight mechanism implemented in their organization, what do you think is the best way to get started with digital standards? What should they do?
I think the first thing is to do an assessment. You know, maybe an organization doesn't have a practice or a team, for example, for digital governance, but maybe there are already elements in place that everybody is following and that can be your standards in disguise. So, for example, maybe in your organization, there is an agreement that everyone will use a certain version of the logo for the profile pictures of social media accounts, or that all websites will be using a particular tool. So when you do this assessment, it will allow you to see what exists, what doesn't, what is mission critical. So for those that already kind of exist in disguise, it will be just a question of articulating them, making them into standards. And for those that are not, do not exist, but then you identify that they're mission critical, you have to see if you have the knowledge in-house to create the standard. You might need to bring external expertise. Or if you have it, you know, inside, you could also, a way to start is looking at things that are guidelines, or even start something as a guideline, which is not mandatory, and see what is the response of people. Are they adopting it? Are they having, you know, a difficult time? And then you can start adjusting. One area that I actually like I think that it's an easy way to start is when it comes to accessibility standards. And this is because the W3C has done a great job creating the web content accessibility guidelines. You know, so these are universal and they help us make our websites accessible for people with disabilities. So first thing to do will be to study those guidelines and decide which ones make sense for the organization, which ones can you put in place. Actually, in some countries, there are laws that certain you know, websites need to be accessible for people with disabilities. So you could also take those into account. And then, you know, you look at these different guidelines, you select them, and that you can transform into your accessibility standards for your organization. And then you can go through the different categories that I mentioned. But an assessment is the first step.
That's great advice. And of course, you know, once you do an assessment and you kind of figure out some standards, I'm assuming you have to get them implemented. So I know that you've had a lot of years experience implementing standards, and this is really where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. How do you personally advise that those in charge of digital standards go about distributing digital standards and really getting staff to adopt them and follow them? Because that's really a challenge.
It is. So I think, you know, you need to educate people. You know, we spend a lot of time educating people through different webinars, speaking to them, explaining. And the thing is that when you cannot just create it, issue it, and think that people are going to adopt it. Again, I think it comes also to the fact that digital sits, you know, in together with various disciplines. So, for example, what I have found is our IT colleagues, they really like policies and standards because they navigate in that world. However, you know, our colleagues in communications or maybe fundraising, marketing, they are less prone to follow policies and standards because they don't necessarily navigate with those in place. So you have to educate. And I think one of the obstacles is that people think that when you put policies and standards into place, these are obstacles, you know, obstacles for creativity, obstacles for many things. But it's actually quite the contrary, because once you kind of explain what are the rules of the game, you can really create amazing products that are going to not only, you know, that you can take to the next level, because they are going to be taking into account safety. They're going to be taking into account consistency of your brand. They will only make your presence stronger. So I think once you start explaining that to people and why you need certain things, then the more you explain, the more people do buy into it. One thing that we did in the organization where I work with, you know, we issue these standards on search engine optimization, but we issue them together with an e-course on SEO. And this was the basic. And whereas the e-course was not a class on the standards, it was about the practice. And we mentioned the standards. So it really complements, and people did see the value of it. And then, you know, those standards can be kind of, because they're much more detailed than how do you do it, then you can follow the standards, and you also can share them with your vendors if you do a lot of outsourcing. So you make sure that they are going to also be implementing those. So there's a lot of education. It's not only issuing them and expecting that people will adopt. I think education becomes, you know, probably, you know, 70% of the work you have to do to create adoption.
So I know that you've actually had a lot of experience in this space. I hope that others can actually understand the value of standards as you have explained it as well. And I'm wondering if somebody's listening to this stream and they see the value of standards and want to get started, what are the three most important things you think that they should consider and take action upon?
I think, you know, again, you have to educate yourself to be able to educate others. So that's a first step, because you will need to really believe in the value of governance, of standards, of policies, to be able to really kind of become an evangelizer for your organization. You have a lot of skeptic people, but then, you know, if you know, you know, the value, if you can stand by it because you have educated yourself, that will be a great step to start, so that, you know, you feel comfortable. Another important thing is don't start working on your digital standards in a silo. You cannot do it yourself. You really need to rely on your subject matter experts and also take into account the people that are going to be putting these standards into place. You know, so never work in a vacuum. That will do you a disservice. And, you know, one thing that we did also, we brought experts, you know, experts in the field that gave us a good foundation. And then that helped us to start, you know, and then continue the implementation. So it's education, seeing what's out there, what makes sense. You have to also kind of have a good knowledge of your organization. Talk to other disciplines where they might have that. So again, IT tends to be a field where, you know, they work much more with standards and procedures and policies, even HR, and, you know, kind of look at those other disciplines and how you can bring that to digital. And you can make it exciting and something really practical for people to implement.
Great. Well, you've definitely inspired me into going to maybe write some digital standards or at least start thinking about them for the afternoon. So thanks so much for sharing your insights, Carolina. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Christina. This was a lot of fun.
Cool. So that was nice change to have an interview.
It was, even though it confused me, but I got it in the end. But yeah, it was like listening to a female version of you, Paul, I have to say.
With a much nicer accent.
Oh, well, yes. Well, no, you've got a nice Worsley accent.
Worsley. I don't think nice and Worsley are two words that go together, are they?
Well, it reminds me of when I was a small boy and I would go back to see my relatives in Devon. So no. I view with affection.
Ah, thank you, Marcus.
There you go.
So yeah, I mean, so many good things in that. I liked her. Well, I think it was Lisa Reichelt actually. Carolina referenced her talking about the different type categories of standards: design, content, publishing, network, and services. I thought that was quite interesting. I never thought about that. I haven't read Lisa Reichelt's book yet. I'm ashamed of myself.
Didn't she edit yours?
I know.
That's poor, Paul.
He's really poor, isn't it?
Yeah. I quite like the... One of the things she said, which I thought, yeah, that's a good idea, which probably people do anyway, was to kind of take existing guidelines and extend those.
Yes! Yeah, like, they're kind of unofficial ones that people are already doing.
Yeah, because it's like... Because people will be working to those. So let's take those and extend them. Rather than this is a brand new thing that you have to adopt and, you know, an additional thing to your work. It's not. It's just it's what you're already doing, but with a few extra bits on. I thought that was wise.
Yes, very wise. I also liked the idea of measuring standards to see how well adopted they've been and whether they're actually working. Again, that's two things she came up with that had never even occurred to me. And that's terrible considering I'm supposed to be like know about this stuff. It's not like she's talking about development. But
the thing that she said quite near the end, which you need to believe in what you're doing to make it work. And that applies to everything. I mean, that applies to sales. Obviously, I've done sales for years. If you don't believe in what you're selling, then you won't sell it. And the same applies to trying to get... Because obviously, it's all very well coming up with new standards for this and new standards for that. But getting people to adopt it is the hard bit. And obviously, she talked about that, talked about education. But you need to believe in it to make that happen.
You're talking about education is another example of something that applies to pretty much most things, you know, whether it's getting approval for design or explaining to clients why performance matters. You know, we need to get so much better at educating clients. And the other thing I really liked as well was the never work in a vacuum bit, which again, I think applies to pretty much anything, not just standards.
Yeah.
So really good.
I agree. Yes. Good talk. Interview.
One of the things that she did, one thing that people might want to check out off the back of her that's popped into my mind is she talked about getting inspiration for your standards and looking elsewhere for them. And it made me think about Jeremy Keith's design principles. So not Jeremy's design principles, but he's got a page of loads of organizations' different design principles. Which is a type of standard. So I'll put a link in the show notes to that. So in fact, I think it's quite easy to remember. It's principles.adaccio.com. Nobody can ever spell Adaccio. So it's adaccio.com. And that's got loads of principles from Google through to, you know, Twitter through to everybody else. It's really good. Lots of inspiration there. Cool. Next up, we've got Teacup AdWords, which is an AdWords campaign management thingy. I'm good at this, aren't I?
I appreciate you calling it a thingy.
No, Dean's lovely. He'll understand. I'm sure he would refer to it as a thingy too. So it's to help effectively manage your AdWords campaigns. Because let's be honest, to do a proper job with AdWords, you need to be willing to commit hours every month. Which And obviously, if you're not willing to do a proper job, then what's the point? You're just, you know, throwing money down the drain. So that means like checking it daily to see how it's performing, making weekly updates and optimizing it every month. And it's a pain in the arse. You've got to find new keywords. You've got to build landing pages. You've got to hunt for keywords that are actually good value and uncover opportunities. And depending on your account, you could be spending 20 hours or more on a single campaign. But Teacup is designed to make all of that easy. It's designed really to do all of it for you, to cut down the amount of management time to really a matter of minutes. It's incredibly straightforward. All you need to do is answer a handful of questions about what you do, and Teacup will find relevant keywords. It'll build landing pages, but it'll also handle everything else like keyword discovery, testing various variations of your ads, all the optimization. It does the whole lot, which is just witchcraft, in my humble opinion. They are currently running a limited invitation to a beta, so they're still kind of exploring how best to do it. So you can be actively involved in shaping the direction of the project. Dean is only looking for a few people to do this, he's kind of increasing that all the time, rolling it out all the time. So you can find out more about that by going to teacupanalytics.com/AdWords. Now, this is kind of quite exciting.
Yeah, it is. I know why you think it's exciting.
So we've got Chris Scott doing
a talk. On the podcast.
Is this only the second time this has ever happened?
I think so. And you wouldn't believe the whining that went on to get him to do this.
Really?
He felt like he had to, but he didn't want to do it at all. But
well, that surprises me for a couple of reasons, right? Yeah. One is that he was incredibly good. I think it's a really good little talk, right? Two, what's he complaining about? It was only 6 minutes. He didn't even make the 10-minute minimum.
I pointed that out to him because, of course, I had to edit it. I pointed that out, and he said something along the lines of short but sweet, or, you know,
some bullshit.
Not quality, not quantity, that kind of stuff.
Right. I have to say, mine, it is good. And it's really funny. It's really bizarre because, so what he's doing is he's talking about card sorting. And he's called it reviving a neglected UX design tool. And it was really funny because I was literally just thinking about this before he submitted it. Because I've been going through my website and looking at old articles. And I came across one about card sorting and thought, oh, I haven't done card sorting for years. And got really quite excited again about it and using it. And then here he comes. So great minds think alike. We have worked together too long,
indeed.
Basically. So, yeah, Chris is, if you don't know, Chris is the managing director of Headscape. So he co-founded Headscape with myself and Marcus, which, as he likes to put it, means that he has to do the stuff that nobody else wants to do. Apparently that's what being a managing director is in his head. Yeah. I thought it was to provide leadership, but apparently not.
He does do that as well. As I think you'll hear from the talk, he is an excellent facilitator of workshops. He's just so thorough.
I know. I don't understand that. We could not have more diametrically opposed approaches to workshops. Because, like, you know, as he says in his talk, he spends hours preparing and, you know, working out everything and having everything perfect beforehand. Well, I just rock up and make it up as I go along. I probably shouldn't say that, should I really?
Yeah. Hire Headscape.
Well,
not Paul Boag.
Yeah, not Paul Boag.
Hire us both. There you go.
You pay us twice. Hire us to work on a project together. It's been a little while, hasn't it?
Yeah, we could do with another one. Big wide world out there listening.
Yeah, although I've literally contacted Chris just before he went away on holiday with a lead of a client I'm working with that I think could do with Headscape's help as well.
Lovely.
So, yeah, there's that, which is good. But no, yeah, if you're out there, reunite the old band.
Yeah, definitely. It's always great when the band gets back together.
Yeah, it always works really well when there's, you know, take that, when they came back together, better than ever before.
Exactly. Maybe maybe they're the exception, but it's normally good for a little while. And then we can have some time off again, and then we'll come back together. Well, it's like, farewell tours.
Yeah. Does that mean one of us is about to die? I don't know. Although, if we take the take that analogy, I am Robbie Williams, which is really quite disturbing.
Although in so many ways, yes, Paul.
Mm, it is. Well, it's better than being Vin Diesel or whatever I was in last season. At least Robbie's got hair.
This is true.
Okay, right. Should we play Chris's talk?
Let's do it.
Shouldn't take long.
Over recent years, I've increasingly neglected card sorting as part of the process of starting up new projects. And when we're starting a project, we do all the usual discovery stuff. We'll kick off workshop where we use a journey map, we discuss high-level navigational structures, and then we dive off into wireframing key pages, all good stuff. Working out information architecture has usually involved a back-and-forth process between UX designer and the client, but done after the initial project workshop. I used to do card sorting, but it just seems to have become a forgotten tool for a while. Maybe I just got lazy and didn't prepare well enough, or maybe I wasn't setting things up right. A year or so ago, I took a fresh look at my lackluster use of card sorting. I gave it another try and haven't looked back since. I'm loving what we've been getting from it, and it's great to see how clients have engaged with it. So what's different? What am I doing differently? To start with, I'm not using online tools or software tools. You know the sort of thing, optimal sort, simple card sort. They can be fun, and the analysis tools can be great if you're getting inputs from a lot of users. What I wanted was to make rapid progress with organising website architecture at project kickoff workshops, and the tools really didn't seem to fit the bill for that. Well, what I've found is that people seem to love having actual physical cards that they can move around. So what about approaches? Closed or open sorts? In practice, what I'm actually doing are what I've called semi-closed sorts. So what do I mean by that? Well, I introduce a workshop session by proposing some top-level categories. Having to do this forces me to do some homework, so I've started to build an initial view in my mind at this stage. That's okay. By putting something out there, you'll force responses from workshop participants. That's a good thing. Usually this session will immediately follow a session or sessions on users, user segments and user journeys. So everyone at the workshop should be warmed up with their brains fully engaged. So what I do is propose some initial top-level categories. We discuss those as a whole workshop, and usually you can develop some sort of consensus on a starting point for the card sort. So coming back to the term I used, semi-closed, what do I mean? Well, I allow workshop participants to change things during the sort if they want. So they've got a starting point, but they can change. The process of sorting is a test of the validity of the top-level categories that we've agreed earlier. So if they're found wanting, they can be changed, and I allow participants to change as they go. Okay, so how do I organise the workshop? First of all, teams. I always divide workshops into at least two teams. Having teams always introduces a bit of competitive edge. That's a good thing. Having teams rather than individuals means that there's discussion and debate. Again, that's all good. I'll come back to teams again later. What about the cards? So I said I didn't use software cards. I always produce a starter set of cards. This is a good discipline as a facilitator because, again, it forces me to do some valuable homework. Also, it means you get a card sorting exercise up and running really fast. Encourage participants to reword cards as they go. Encourage them to use a reject pile. Encourage them to add new cards. What about card technologies? So what I do is print my starter set of card text on sticky address labels. Participants have then got to create the actual cards by sticking those labels onto post-it notes. It might seem like a really trivial point, but the process of making cards in this way, even though it only takes a second or so, means that someone in the team has had to actually spend the second or so looking at the text on the card. I don't know, I've not got any scientific evidence, but it seems to help. Teams can organise as they stick, or do all the sticking and then organise. Whichever approach they use, the process of having labelled post-its to move around inevitably stimulates discussions. Use big wall spaces if you can find them. Big vertical surfaces are best, but sometimes clients are precious about their walls, in which case you'll have to make do with a big table. The best bit comes at the end of the process, where you need to get each team to look at the outputs of the other teams. Then get each team to make a brief pitch for their differences, so the things that they've identified that are different to what the other teams are suggesting or proposing. As a facilitator, it's your job to keep the discussions and arguments focused on the users and user journeys you've analysed earlier. Workshop participants will often lapse back to their own issues and concerns rather than the needs of users. You need to keep challenging them on how the architecture they're proposing will help users to achieve what they want. You might not end up with total consensus, in which case someone will need to make some editorial decisions, but you'll have surfaced a lot of issues, generated a lot of buy-in from participants, and you should be close to a workable architecture.
So there you go. Chris Scott's been on the podcast.
Oh, no, it's great, isn't it? Well, you know, he inspired me too. I was doing card sorting with our American client on Monday, 2 days ago. He reinvigorated my interest in it as well. Because what happened was, when I was listening to the talk earlier on today, I realised that why I fell out of love with it is because I kept trying to do it with students. Who didn't really care, is the bottom line.
Yeah.
And it was all completely open. This open card sorting is, here you are, here's a deck of cards, sort them out into groups. Whereas closed card sorting is, this is the top level of navigation for a site. Here's a deck of cards, put them in each one. So,
yeah.
And Chris is saying that, you know, a kind of start in off between. With an idea of the top, top, but you can change it if you want to. And which makes a lot of sense. So that's why I just found I got useless results. But I think it was just because I was working with people that weren't really kind of bought into it. But it worked a treat with the law firm we were working with on Monday, 2 days ago.
I think, you know, it's different situations require different approaches. I mean, I could imagine some people were listening to Chris going, well, I don't know about that. You're leading people by setting top-level sections. And yeah, I guess he is, really. But sometimes it's necessary, I think, to stimulate discussion because people find it much easier to respond to something than they do to start from scratch. If you say, you know, here's a blank page, get on with it, they go, But if you show them something, they'll quite happily rip it apart.
Yeah, it's also about getting something useful at the end of it. Because we had a huge group over these last couple of days, and we divided them into five teams. Mm-hmm. Now, if we'd made it completely open, all right, maybe not for a law firm because there's a kind of standard structure for law firms, but let's say if there wasn't that, we could have ended up with five completely different potential structures, and you're like, well, what use is that?
Yeah.
So if you guide people to begin with, it means that you're more likely to get something useful out at the end of it. And that's what this is all about, really. It's also about them having fun, feeling part of feeling part of the workshop rather than just sitting back listening to me waffle on. Doing stuff is really helpful, and it was great.
It's a chance to educate and engage, really. And people, you get buy-in as well from getting clients doing this kind of stuff. The other thing that I think I'm quite keen is this works really well with something like a top task analysis exercise that, you know, if you've gathered a load of tasks that users want to complete or a load of questions that they want answering, it's a really good way of rolling you know, rationalizing those into some kind of information architecture and some kind of structure, which works really well. The other thing that I liked that Chris said, which I thought was a good idea, and I've never thought about doing, is the idea of if you've got multiple teams and they come up with different approaches, getting them to pitch why they've gone with the way they've gone.
Yep.
As a way of kind of structuring, you know, providing a structured discussion. So I quite like that.
Yeah. The way we got them each to, you're basically pitching why you've taken a different route maybe to the kind of what's expected.
Yeah.
And we did that with each of the five teams we had. And while they're talking, Lee and I were kind of pulling together everything into the next stage of the workshop was for us to work on the IA, taking on board all of the things that they'd done. So it informed our work. It informed the next step really well.
Good.
So that was good. Yeah, I was impressed. Well done, Chris.
So the way that Chris and you are using it is more as a facilitation tool rather than a user research tool, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, we're working with a client rather than sitting down with users. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, it does work with users as well, but you are right. You can, you know, if you don't have an engaged group of users, it can feel like pulling teeth.
Yeah.
The other thing, of course, you can do is qualitative card sorting, where you actually just open up your card sorting to a large number of people online, like, say, all your Facebook followers or all your Twitter followers, and see whether any common trends come out of something like that. So it really is quite a versatile tool, but it's knowing how to use it in the right way at the right time. It's like all these things, isn't it, really?
Definitely.
Okay, so I think we're doing really well. I think this is going to be a short show. That's probably because we're
suits
both...
Suits me today, Paul.
We just want it over, don't we? Yeah,
then I can just go and lie down somewhere.
So I did want to say before we do your joke and wrap up the show that I still have 3 slots left, right? So I need 3 more people to submit talks. Now, you might think, well, 3's not many. It's not worth me doing it because it'll be gone by the time that it actually gets around to it. But I've had 3 now for several weeks, despite mentioning it on the show multiple times. So you've all gone quiet on me. Get off your arse. Give me a talk.
Well, I have seen Mr. Lee Howes's notes.
Ah.
He just hasn't recorded it yet.
Well, I suspect he's not alone in that.
Mm.
So I'm telling everybody off. It's always good to tell your listeners off, especially when you want them to do something for you for free at that.
Yeah.
I tell you what.
It's fame and fortune. That's what it is. Fame, in inverted commas, is what it is.
Really? There's not that many people listen to this show. That's why people can't be bothered. I tell you what. I'll give you, if you submit a talk and you get on the show in the last 3 slots, I'll give you a copy of one of my books, a physical copy. I will post it to you and sign. No, I won't sign it because then you won't want it. Christine Rapt. Yeah. So there you go. Because I need to fill up these spaces. Now you can't accuse me of not giving you anything. And of course, now everybody else who's already been on the show is going to be really resentful that they're not getting a book.
Yeah, where's my damn book, Paul?
Oh, no.
Because I've been on the show.
Have I still not given you a copy of User Experience Revolution?
I don't have a copy, nope.
I thought I sent you one.
Address that I frequent.
Oh, well, hot cheese.
Yeah, you don't care.
No, not in the slightest. All right, Marcus, what's your joke?
Well, I've been told, in again, Biogworld Slack channel, that I have to tell this joke from Aslan Kassan. But I don't think it quite works. But I'm going to try it anyway.
Okay, right.
So why do Swedish warships have barcodes on the sides?
It's going to be something to do with IKEA.
No. So that when they return to port, they can Scandinavian. They can Scandinavian.
Mm. No, that works.
Scandinavian. Yeah, that's what it was, more Anne. I was like, Scandinavian?
Yeah. No, it's Scandinavian.
Scandinavian.
Yeah, no, go. That works. It's not funny, but it works.
There you go. Anyway, I did as I was told.
Yeah, don't argue with the slack. Right, that's it. We're done. All right, thank you very much for listening, and we'll be back again next week when we might be coherent. Bye.